Hello there and welcome along to this week's The Front Page. I'm Maddie Plale and it's been a busy, a sad in many ways, and an interesting week in racing. We've had the loss of a jump racing icon, we've had a groundbreaking survey from the Gambling Commission, and we've also had the summer showpiece of the King George at Ascot. We're going to talk about the fallout of those three stories. I'm in the company of James Stevens, our West Country correspondent, and our industry editor, Bill Barber, in the studio today. Great to have you both here. No messing around on Skype, no dreaded earpieces. James, how's your week been?
Yeah, very good, thanks. Getting ready for what is an absolute carnage week working at this place with Goodwood and Galway. So much good racing on at the minute. The summer's out, it's nice weather, it's all good. But it's going to be a really, really busy week and so much to look forward to really as well.
Indeed. Bill, you produced a lot of column inches last week, as ever, one of the hardest working members of the Racing Post. And I'm sure you're going to tell us a bit about that in just a moment. But how have things been?
Yeah, well, as you say, it's been a busy week. So and yes, as we'll discuss shortly. But yeah, all good otherwise. Thank you.
Fantastic. So I've teased the three stories that we're going to be discussing on today's show. We're going to start off with your story, Bill. In the first annual report of the Gambling Survey for Great Britain, the GSGB, it was released on Thursday. There's been lots of talk about this survey beforehand, the statistics used, how they're used, how unreliable they are, or at least how much they can be questioned, and the responses to them, what it means to, you know, the landscape of gambling in this country going forward, particularly with regards to the affordability checks and racing's all-important income streams. Just tell us a little bit about what work you've been up to this week with the survey being announced.
Yes, well, as I say, it's been a busy week, and it's been occupying most of my time. So if this becomes a bit of a stream of consciousness, do please feel free to interrupt. So yes, as you said, the Gambling Survey for Great Britain was published by the Gambling Commission on Thursday. It's been well flagged, it's been work that's been going on for a while, and this will these will become the new official statistics for gambling, and they replace the old, what were described as the gold standard National Health Service surveys, which used to produce figures for how much people gambled, how much gambling participation what there was, and the sort of the crucial figure is the problem gambling rate. So under those old NHS surveys, the problem gambling rate was around 0.3, 0.5%. The main headline from the GSGB is that the problem, it produced a problem gambling rate of 2.5%. Now, this was what was seized upon by all the media outlets. Obviously, that's a much higher figure than previously sort of published. And campaigners and politicians, people wanting gambling reform, have seized upon this figure, basically saying this shows that the issue of problem gambling has been underreported, that it's a much bigger issue than previously sort of said. But there are a few issues with the survey. Even the Gambling Commission has acknowledged that there are problems with the survey. And indeed, the Gambling Commission has told media and campaigners that it will take action if anybody misuses these statistics.
Right.
One of those being you shouldn't compare them to the previous ones, which actually makes reporting on them quite difficult.
Yeah, it sounds like a challenging thing to address. We've had fallout from both the government and the BHA. Just explain a little bit about why these statistics are deemed unreliable. Why have we got to be very careful about how we interpret them?
Yeah, well, as I say, even the Gambling Commission is saying they need to be treated with caution. So basically the reason for that is it uses a different methodology to the ones, the NHS one. So it's done via, it's push to web is how it's described. So it's mainly online, whereas previously the NHS surveys were done sort of face to face. And there was a much greater response rate to the NHS surveys as well. But one of the main issues with the reliability, and even one of the academics who has, I mean, he described the methodology he's been pretty praiseworthy about the GSGB, but Professor Sturgis of the London School of Economics has basically warned that there's a non-negligible risk that these statistics overstate gambling participation and gambling prevalence, and that's because it's sort of the feeling is that it oversamples gamblers and committed gamblers, and if that's the case, you're going to get more problem gamblers responding to the survey. So that is the main reason why the Gambling Commission said these statistics need to be treated with caution. You shouldn't compare them with the previous figures. You shouldn't gross them up to say this many people in the Britain have got problem gamblers. Unfortunately, I mean, they gave this guidance before the survey was published, but quite a few media outlets have not really taken that on board, and some of the campaigners have basically ignored it. So that's why there are concerns about the reliability and the gambling, the industry body, the Betting and Gaming Council, said, you know, these figures need to be treated with caution. They may not be robust. So, so that's one of the sort of the main issues about it.
And what do you think this is going to mean for the future? If I could force you to get out your crystal ball, I mean, how damaging is this going to be? We know that gambling is a hot topic in Parliament at the moment. Of course, it's such a crunch time for the industry. How is this survey going to impact the future of that?
Well, the issue is whether the government, the new government, is basically forced to revisit gambling reforms as a result. So the previous government took an awful long time, but it finally got its gambling white paper out last year. Reforms started to be put into place, including affordability checks. Then the general election happened, so things have sort of, in quite a few areas, have halted for now. The Labour government has so far given an indication that it's basically going to let these reforms play through. But you've already had campaigners saying we need to ban all gambling advertising in sports because of these figures. Now, that would obviously be a massive issue for racing, unless it could get a carve out. Another potential issue is that the previous problem gambling rate informed the thresholds for the affordability checks.
Yes.
That are going to be trialled from the start of from the end of next month. So if pressure builds and Labour looks at those figures, that could put downward pressure on those thresholds. I mean, you've even had campaigners saying we need a whole new gambling bill because of this. I mean, that would take a lot of time, throw things into a lot of confusion. So it really depends on what the government says. The government has said it will carefully consider this new survey. We've got a new gambling minister, Baroness Fiona Twycross, whose appointment was announced the day before the survey came out last week, which is a bit of a surprise because everyone was expecting Stephanie Peacock, who'd held the position in opposition, to continue as gambling minister. So she's going to have this survey sort of plonked on her desk. She's got to somehow get her head around all this rather heavily caveated figures.
Yeah, difficult to understand and interpret, and yet more uncertainty going forward. James, you've been looking at how media outlets have been responding to this and interpreting it.
Yeah, interesting. As Bill mentioned there, it was in your report, you sort of mentioned it's almost a bit of a notes to editors that there's this new information available and you need to treat it with caution. But that's not always the way it happens. The Daily Mail destroy on this, where they took this data and really expanded it to suggest that 1.6 million British people may have a gambling issue, either using the 2.5 and doing their own maths. Now, that's clearly already a sign of the danger that this can be, because it's clearly known to the people who've made this and what's come out since, that number is exaggerated. So the figure that this 1.6 million is completely wrong, but people will read that headline and it will unfortunately, what's going to happen is it's going to lead people to feel a certain way, which isn't necessarily true. And that's what's dangerous about this misinformation, is that things can change and people's perspective are created over information that's not necessarily true. Other news, you know, there has Guardian and The Mirror did stories on this where they've cautioned that the figures aren't exactly 100% and there's a risk attached to them, which is important that it's clear. But the issue is, as Bill knows, that this is just news reporting on three of the leading news websites. Social media is where a lot of people get their news, and there isn't necessarily a a rule in place or a media law book where you have to say, right, make sure you do this and make sure you do that. It's a free market, and for a lot of campaigners, they will use information, anything really, that gets that point across. It's the nature of, if you believe in something, you want to use things to make it seem your way. And it's worrying for racing perspective. You know, it's another bit of ammunition that the anti-gambling and people who want stricter control will have. But for me, it's incredibly frustrating, because for all that, you know, we don't want strict rules, affordability checks, we know the damage they're going to cause. This is potentially a chance to really assess and understand the situation, which is completely lost. Because now we don't actually know how serious the problem is. We've not got an accurate number which we can look at. And in terms of improving that situation, it makes it a lot tougher, because we're going, well, on the one hand this, but on the other hand that. It's a real shame. And I don't envy the new gambling minister. Good luck.
Good luck indeed. If you'd like to capture up on the two parts of Bill's special report, then make sure to join our members club. There's also plenty of stuff there to help inform your punting at Galway and Goodwood this week.
Get 50% off your first 3 months in the Racing Post members club. As a member, you get access to the digital newspaper exclusively available to members the night before. You'll get daily tips on the likes of Pricewise, Tom Siegel, Robbie Wilders and Paul Keighley. Enjoy award-winning journalism from the industry's best writers and watch replays from all British and Irish racing, now available within the Racing Post app. Subscribe today and get 50% off your first 3 months membership.
One of the most popular horses that British jump racing has seen passed away last week in the shape of the three-time champion hurdler, Istabrak. He was trained to perfection by Aidan O'Brien and ridden so well by Charlie Swan. The pair built up an incredible relationship over the years, winning those three champion hurdles from 1998 to 2000. And another one may have been cruelly snatched away from him as well due to the foot and mouth crisis. He passed away last week at the grand old age, it must be said, of 32. And James, this is your story this week, so I'll go over to you. A sad, sombre note, but equally a life incredibly well lived.
It is, Maddie, and you're donning the funeral attire to pay your tribute to Istabrak on the show today.
I'm the only one in black, so I'm paying my respects.
No, I think just a classic, really popular, fantastic jumps horse. And these are the horses that we love to remember and recall, and I'm sure everyone has their own Istabrak stories. I mean, a three-time champion hurdle winner who was, at his best, absolutely flawless. The way he travelled in his races was exceptional, and his jumping, I'm interested to read some of the comments about, as it described as like a cat. He'd sort of start before the rest of them would even consider jumping, and then by the end of it, he was flawless and quick and brilliant. He was a real top-class hurdler. I was having a read last night of Alistair Down's comments. I've got like a best of Alistair Down book, and his comments after his third win, and sort of again where there was this nosebleed just before the race, and there was a bit of uncertainty, and that was the thing with Istabrak, is that he was fantastic, but there was always just this sense of something could go wrong here. But he always, you know, he always seemed to deliver, except the year he physically couldn't get his chance because of foot and mouth. A fantastic horse, and to read some of the comments from JP McManus and Aidan O'Brien, people that in racing we look at as just these absolute like god icon like figures. And Aidan O'Brien is there saying, this is a horse who made me, this is a horse who's, I've learned so much from this horse, and just really taken aback. And with JP McManus as well, how much he seriously loves his horses, and this one in particular. You know, we hear all the time about Martinstown, the facilities got, how well he looks after his horses post-retirement, and it's amazing to see that this horse has lived till 32. And Charlie in his piece even mentioning that part of that was the care they get there, but to JP really moved by a horse. That's a side of him we don't really see. We sort of hear about these gambles, we sort of see the different coloured hats and try and wonder out this man, but he's so moved by this horse. And at Cheltenham, I mean, it's a place which I've been lucky enough to cover for a few years now. There are horses that move that place. There are horses that people warm to. They don't happen often, but there are ones that come along and it's special, and then there are ones that come across that are very, very special. And he was one of them. And for so many people watching racing now, who are involved in racing now, it'll all go back to Istanbul.
It will, and isn't that a wonderful tribute? Bill, myself and James, we were either born only just or weren't born in Istabrak's prime and his pomp, but even we can recognise, you know, the magnitude of his popularity and just how important he was for racing. You were around, mm-hmm. and you actually have a rather interesting link to him.
Well, yes, I suppose I had the most minuscule part of a horse that actually beat Istabrak. But on the flat.
That's some claim to fame, regardless.
It was on the flat, though. I don't know if that's a massive claim to fame.
Was he with John Gosdenham? Don't know how much.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the thing about Istabrak, he was bred to win a derby. He was Sadler's Wells, and a half brother to Secreto in the 84 derby. But yes, I suppose it's a bit of a strange memory to have, or sort of. The biggest memory I have of him is actually his last race when I'd not been at the racing post long, when he ran in his last champion hurdle, and I remember being on the steps watching, and it was evident he wasn't going too well. He was pulled up, and you know, it's not often where a hot favourite in the champion hurdle is applauded pulling up, you know, with the race barely having got underway, but that was. That was the sort of the public feeling about Istabrak. So
if you could sum up what he meant to people, I mean, the 14 Grade Ones, that's exceptional, really. We've seen some incredible hurdlers in recent years, you know, Hurricane Fly, many, many horses who have won a similar amount of Grade Ones. But what do you think it was that sort of attracted people to Istabrak?
I suppose he was just a winning machine, really. It was a real shock if he ever got beat. I remember it was Pridwell, wasn't it, at Aintree?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, that was earth shattering that Istabrak somehow got. But he was just, you know, he was just a winning machine, just flamboyant jumper, just never, you know, he was just a top class hurdler. And I suppose one of the things was it sort of harked back to that golden era, which I can just about remember, of the Monk's Fields and Night Nurses and Sea Pigeons, and a bit of a throwback to those days. Someone who could be held in comparison with those great names.
Yeah, well, I'm sure it won't be the last time that we reference the great old Istabrak when discussing the new pretenders, the likes of Constitution Hill, the upcoming jump season. Thoughts with all who were involved in a wonderful career, and what a legacy he leaves. Now, onwards, and we will continue talking about another huge figure in racing, the winner of the King George and Queen Elizabeth Kipco Stakes, just after this. Welcome back to the final instalment of this week's Front Page, and it's my turn to go last, hopefully saving the best until last. I was at Ascot on Saturday to witness a fantastic King George. Auguste Rodin was sent off favourite for the second consecutive year. That top class horse was bidding for a seventh Group 1, but it wasn't to be. There was a shock in the case of the French-trained Goliath, who travelled ultra smooth under Christophe Soumillon to win the race for France. Plenty of fallout, including from Aidan O'Brien, who said that the ground was nowhere near as described. He launched a bit of an attack on Chris Stickles, but an incredibly absorbing race, one that had great intrigue from a tactical perspective. Hans Andersen, Luxembourg went off fast. Rebel's Romance was in the box. CE was a key fancy for many. Auguste Rodin was stuck on the inside, something Aidan O'Brien referenced afterwards, saying that it was cut up and soft and full of sand down there and he should have been out wider. The key protagonist did come from further back. Goliath was settled further behind after his effort in the Hardwick Stakes last time. And Blue Stocking was near enough last, and she came with a storming run to finish second. it was a really, really interesting race. We were talking about it before, James. I often think when results like this happen and they're a bit unexpected, people can just discard them straight away as a fluke. But, you know, there was no fluke about the style of the performance anyway. And now this horse is a gelding, so we won't see him in the Prix de l'Arc de Triomphe later on this year. But he does have plenty of other options, including back at the scene of the crime for the Champion Stakes. Connection's also wondering whether they'll take in the Grosser Priest von Baden-Baden. But Goliath, let's give him the credit he deserves. This was a mega performance. Wasn't really asked for maximum effort under Christophe Soumillon. Were you as surprised as everyone else?
I was massively surprised. I'd love to say I was one of the people that saw the form lines and stuff, but not at all. The way he travelled through the race, it was a textbook way to win a middle distance race, wasn't it? You travel like the best horse and then you find plenty and you finish strong at the line. He did everything right in that perspective, and you can't watch that race back and think, okay, there's any fluke about it at all. The RPRs, 1-2-8, would say he's up there with Adia Hookham last year. Same sort of, so it's a very good performance. The way the race panned out was a bit interesting because some of the fastest sectionals were quite early on in the race. So
yeah,
it really put it on, as in the pressure was on staying, and he stayed very well. So interesting from that perspective, but I don't think you can look at it as a fluke at all by the manner in which he won. Really, really impressive, and it's an interesting race with all the different form lines from around the world. And you know, the more you look back through his form, he's been an improving horse all the time. And you mentioned there about the gelding, the cruel clip, which means we can't see him in the arc. I mean, it is a shame we don't get to see him and the King Edward winner. The name always escapes me, of a very good King Edward winner.
Calandagan,
thank you very much. Two very exciting middle distance horses that don't get to run in the arc. It's a shame, but I don't necessarily think on the back of two winners like that, the whole rule needs to be changed. And I think there's something about the colts and the great esteem of the Arc as a race. I mean, when I was in Japan earlier this year, the way the Arc is talked about, like some heaven-like place, and although you'd think it brings back so many painful memories, it's like one day, we are going to do it one day. And it's because it's the generation-defining race. You know, the winner of the Arc gets to produce the next generation. And I think there's something really important about that from a perspective, not just from a racing perspective, from a breeding and a longevity perspective. So if geldings, who can have an advantage, do start winning the race, then suddenly that just takes it away. But the lucky thing for these connections is there are a lot of very good middle distance races which can be won with this horse, and winning the King George opens a lot of doors for entries and free, so you know, all the jurisdictions are like, oh, you've won the King George, you can have a free entry here, free entry there. So be very interested to see sort of how that campaign goes and whether they do look at it a bit more and realise how good he looked, because the world is his oyster. But no, very impressive winner. And Auguste Rodin, he is a bit of a character. I always like hearing trainers and jockeys talk about the ground after the race when they've lost. This is one of the good cases of that. Never quite as lovely as when you win, but he's a very good horse, and I'm sure he'll bounce back as he always does.
Yeah, there was a crowd of us at Ascot trying to get to Aidan O'Brien after he was seen speaking to Ryan Moore, and we were expecting him to give his usual gracious explanation, which he did, but at the same time it was pretty punchy from the mighty man at Ballydoyle, Bill, basically saying that there was no good to firm in the ground whatsoever, and that there was, you know, soft in it, as a matter of fact. As James has touched upon, though, this horse, Auguste Rodin, he's either been fantastic or he's been terrible. This was a bit more of a middling performance. He did at least finish mid-pack. He was given the perfect toe into the race by his stablemates Hans Andersen, and then Luxembourg slipped away from the rail to let him up the inside. Turns out the inside might not have been a place to be, but I found it very interesting that Aidan O'Brien spoke in such damning terms almost about the ground. What do you make of it?
The
times certainly suggest it wasn't that bad.
No, absolutely. I'm going to caveat these comments with that it's a long time since I've actually reported on what actually happened on the track, let alone analysed it. And I've I'll hold my hands up. I've only seen the race once live, so I will delve into the sectionals and stuff at a later date. The impression I got watching it was that they messed up with the pacemakers. They went too hard, and August Rodin was sat too close to a fast pace. But as I say, I'm caveating that. That visual impression might not be stood up with the figures. I mean, I do like him as a horse. It seems the feast or famine with him, isn't it?
He's Marmite, and Goliath, clearly, we should give him plenty of credit, shouldn't we, for winning? I mean, you'll have seen more King Georges than myself and James. How do you think he matches up with that acceleration he showed, even if tactics did favour him?
Yes, he did. No, that was impressive. Again, I'm just going to hang fire before I anoint him as a star. Not that anybody would care if I anointed him as a star or not. We'll see. I'm not sure how good a race it was, how good a King George it was, personally. But I could be proven wrong. He could dot up in all sorts of Group 1s from now on. So
should he be allowed to run in the Arc?
I would disagree with James a bit there. I think classics, the classics keep those to colts, but I think with the Arc, you're looking for the best horse, really. I'd let Geldings run in the Arc myself.
Okay, bit of disagreement on this week's show. Those are the three main stories, but before we move on, I just want to reference something that happened at Utoxeter yesterday in the handicap chase. There was a very interesting finish and subsequent stewards inquiry that I covered, James. Flikuvoyu had a substantial lead into the final fence of one of the races. He made a bad mistake under Danny McMenamin, and the rallying get-up mush under Harry Skelton had to briefly switch around him after the final fence and got up to force a dead heat. The judge came through that the verdict was a dead heat, and then sometime afterwards the stewards' inquiry was announced, and eventually after the stewards had done their investigation and spoken to the jockeys, they instated Get Up Mush as the outright winner. This result has caused some controversy, including from the likes of ITV Racing contributor Chris Hughes, for the wording of the stewards' report and the ultimately the decision to change the result. It's a tricky one. The trainer involved, Henry Hogarth, was saying to me yesterday that he doesn't quite really understand what happened. He wasn't sure whether he was going to appeal the result. Danny McMenamin also, it's worth saying, in that mistake at the last, lost his irons, so therefore was forfeiting some control over Flikuvoyu. Why do you think this has got people so animated?
I think visually, when a jockey loses the irons, it's very clear to see. But there's lots of interest these jockeys do on horses, which the stewards might pick up on, and the casual viewer might not be able to see. But something as clear and obvious as that is very clear to see why the events have unfolded the way they have. And when it's obvious to you and you watch the videos, it's easy to see, okay, come on, I'm not quite sure about that. The whole situation was quite strange. Timings of stewards and things like that is one of my big frustrations. Generally, I've been on race courses for many a time where that stewards just hangs and hangs and hangs, and punters are sort of waiting to cash in their slips, and the bookies can't pay out. And a lot of the time they are pretty mindless cases as well, which you're almost certain the result's not going to get changed. And the length of the gap here is particularly strange. I personally didn't see the result being changed myself. I thought that was just what race riding is, and that's what race racing's like. And whether I felt the need to necessarily change the result, probably not. I'd be interested to see what connections feel after the dust has settled a little bit, whether the frustrations, not necessarily them, but the outrage of social media might come into play, and they would think, okay, we could change this result here. It was the stewards' report. I'm not quite sure I was that worked up about the comments on there. I think that's quite the same sort of style of language that's usually used, but certainly a strange case. And the margins are always the key thing here, and I think given that it was a dead heat, no margin at all, it's unsurprising that this decision is made. But it'd be interesting to see if they do appeal it and what that outcome will be.
Indeed. I'll read out the steward's report for you now quickly, given that is what many people have an issue with. It read, the stewards considered that the interference had improved Flickervoy's placing as the gelding had made a mistake at the last fence, which resulted in McMenamin losing his irons and his mount edging right-handed into the path of Get Up Mush, who had to be switched around the eventual winner and briefly lost ground in doing so. The interference was found to be accidental as McMenamin was quick to correct his mount, having become briefly unbalanced after losing his irons. So the wording of that is slightly confusing, but I'm sure we'll hear more on the case in the next couple of hours, let alone days. But that's where we're at with Utoxeter at the moment. All that's left for me to do now is to award the winning story, and I think it's got to go to you this week, James. Sat on the end there, Istabrak was such a legendary figure in racing.
Yeah.
And we'll all miss him. And it was great to see those updates in his retirement, wasn't it? With them celebrating his 32nd birthday. That's an incredible age for a horse, isn't it?
Yes, it's quite remarkable. And I think it says a lot about how well he's been looked after throughout his career that he's lived to that age. But yeah, not bad getting a jump story in between the King George and Glorious Goodwood. And Galway, of course, should I say. But yeah, in between those two especially is a... I'll take that. That's a highlight for me on my front page trips.
Fantastic. Well, all that's left to say is we look forward to hearing your comments on the video. Comment down below with your thoughts on this week's big stories, and we'll see you again in a week's time. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you to James and Bill, and we'll see you very soon.